Welcome to Gender Troubles. I'm Emma Austin.
I'm Eva Espenshade.
And we majored in gender studies.
So you don't have to.
Hey, Eva, how's it going?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Doing well. Our audience doesn't know this, but we've been chatting for a while now.
Yeah, so. we're in the groove.
Yes.
And it's been a hot minute since we recorded something.
Yeah. For those of you that maybe haven't heard from us for a bit, we did release an episode on Halloween, but we only released it on our Patreon.
That's right. So if you want to listen to it, even though it's not Halloween, it can still be Halloween. Mm-hmm. We're at patreon.com/gender_troubles. And we're also on Twitter at gendertroubles1 and on Instagram at gender.troubles.pod.
Yes, and that Patreon episode is a Halloween special, and we talk about two movies. We talk about Jennifer's Body, and we talk about A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. So if you're interested, check it out. Mm-hmm. And also, Gender Troubles is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. So if you want to read about our podcast and lots of other really cool leftist podcasts in Canada and listen to them, head to harbingermedianetwork.com.
All right.
So what are we talking about today?
Well, we're talking about the wages for housework movement, which is something I wanted to talk about for a really long time. I think it was like one of the first episode ideas I put on our like initial brainstorming doc. And this is kind of, so I keep saying that we're going to like end talking about second wave feminism and then like we continue to talk about different facets of second wave feminism, but this is like giving us a really good concrete ending because nice. The wages for housework movement is kind of like second wave feminism, like getting something right. And like with all the talk about how radical feminism and second wave feminism like kind of splintered the feminist movement and how you got these more like narrowly defined identity categories that feminism was based on. Then at the very kind of end in the late 70s, which is when like the wages for housework movement was happening, you end up with this really wonderful unifying movement. That's like one of the true like intersectional, transnational, cross-class like things we had in terms of right. second wave feminism. And you had like very different feminist groups and organizations that were rooted in specific identities. And they were all kind of like adding to and branching off from like the basics of the wages for housework movement. And my mom thinks that I'm too harsh on second wave feminists.
Okay.
She listens to the podcast.
Hello, Eva's mom.
Hi, Lisa. And we were chatting about it last week, and I was like trying to express to her that my beef, and maybe this is also your opinion too, like my beef isn't really with like the individual second wave feminists, like my grandmother was, but like rather with like many of the feminist leaders of the time who were like theorizing and mobilizing around a very specific version of womanhood and like the female experience.
Mm-hmm.
And like given the nature of companionship and community like within specific locations, like it makes sense to me why second wave feminists would kind of like identify shared experiences amongst their peers and then kind of ascribe those experiences to the universal woman.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you and I gathered up like 20 or so women we knew and like plopped them into a living room and we hosted a conscious raising session and didn't think super critically about like the limitations of our living room data set, then yeah, like we would walk away with a general idea of what the composite woman's life is like.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen with wages for housework, which is pretty cool. And this is the episode where second wave feminism is vindicated because they found a really basic common struggle and then built up around it and allowed for like organic branching out. Mm-hmm. And it was generative and cool and also debatably successful.
Nice.
And like save for upper class women who like could afford full-time domestic workers, like housework and care work is like a concrete experience that essentially like all women can relate to. Mm-hmm. Housework cuts across racial, national, class, and religious backgrounds. And like, yes, men do housework and men do care work. But looking at the big picture, like women consistently do more housework than men. Women consistently do more care work than men. And mm-hmm. I'll link some stats in the show notes about kind of the percentages all across like North America, Europe. But I'm not going to talk about it here because I find talking about percentages can be really boring.
Yeah.
Do you find like you live with men?
I do.
Do you? I live with a man. Do you find that you do more housework or whatnot?
I actually only live with one man now.
Oh.
I used to live with two. That sounds very...
Sounds like one ate the other one.
It sounds a lot more controversial than it is. I used to have a boyfriend and a roommate. Now I just have a boyfriend.
Now you have a fiance.
Yes. I'm very lucky. I feel like we have like a very good understanding, and he's really like when he first moved in with me after like a couple months, he was like, so how do you feel like this is working as far as like each of our labor and like who's doing more labor? Like, do you feel like I need to, you know, is there anywhere I can like step up? And that like blew my fucking mind, because after like 10 years of dating cis men.
Yeah.
I've never had that like conversation or that offer to have that conversation. That's why I'm marrying him.
Yeah. When you find one, you just got to lock him down.
Yeah. It's like, okay, you're mine forever. Yes. I will keep you. Yeah. So I'm really lucky, but it's definitely been my reality throughout my other relationships where like especially living with previous partners or even like roommates that were dudes, where like, yeah, I was consistently the only one cleaning, especially like doing like the deep cleaning. Like, yes, the bathroom does need to be cleaned sometimes. Like, washing your dishes is not just like sufficient. You haven't just done your job by doing that. Like, there are, you know, and the amount of like beard hair I would fucking like mop up like every week. It's just like, do you just cut your beard and then you just leave it all just like all over the bar of soap and stuff? Like, that's so nasty. So yes, I have in the past, yes, done a lot more housework than my male companions.
Some of the research that I was reading that's more kind of like statistics and whatnot also notes that like while like a couple might share doing housework more, the men tend to do tasks that are less repetitive and less frequent. So like taking out the trash or like mowing the lawn as opposed to folding laundry, washing dishes, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. When they also tend to do the tasks that are like outside of the home, right? Yes. So like the mowing the lawn and the taking out the trash is like the external world.
Yes.
And that the women inhabit the internal place.
That's
where,
true.
You know, yeah.
So yeah, I think everyone who's listening to this right now can probably relate to housework kind of sucking, especially when you're doing it under kind of an assumption that this is just what you do. And that's where the wages for housework movement came up. That's what we're going to talk about. So,
cool. I don't know anything about this, so I'm really excited.
The wages for housework movement was kind of like officially birthed at something called the International Feminist Collective, which was founded in Padua, Italy. And you had women from England, Italy, US, Canada, and they all attended the IFC's founding and started the international campaign with the goal to reach as many women as possible with the wages for housework movement. And it was a really big campaign. It spread all over Europe and the Americas, and members did a bunch of different ways to reach out to women. They had meetings, they gave out pamphlets, they hosted like street events, they spoke at women's centers, and they wrote songs, one of which is called The Housewife's Lament, is actually the theme song for another awesome Harbinger podcast, the Anti-Girl Boss Socialist Club. So really getting the word out. And essentially, the Wages for Housework movement called for the recognition and payment for all housework and care work. And we talk about care work, we're talking about stuff like childcare and kind of like emotional support and helping with schoolwork and doing all these other helping with other family members who may be living in the house. But kind of, I'll probably just say housework a lot instead of saying both. But yeah, so they were calling for housework, care work, and other unwaged labor to be paid. And it was also a movement that was like explicitly anti-war, because they proposed that the funding for the housework would come from different countries' military budgets.
Nice.
And I find it's kind of best to describe the wages for housework movement as like a two-part strategy. So like part one is like a demand for the acknowledgement that domestic and care work is work, and work that people, mostly women, have been socialized and trained to do since birth. For example, by like watching your mother parent and do housework for years and years and years, or doing activities that are very kind of like gendered, like home economics or like Girl Scouts or whatever you want to call it. So the movement, it's about shifting the cultural understanding of what labor is valuable to include feminized and also racialized jobs. Mm-hmm. And secondly, in demanding wages for housework, you're kind of drawing attention to the far-reaching hands of capitalism and are trying to divert funds from the military, like imperialist force, into the homes of workers. So this proposed diversion offers us a way to like radically rethink what is considered valuable labor and resources, and to offer a path to lead towards a much like larger radical restructuring of society and or communist revolution. So though it was like a concrete movement with a list of demands, it was also very much a political perspective. Mm-hmm. And confusion, which I'll talk about later, kind of stems from some people not understanding that it can be both things.
Right.
And part of why I think that this movement was so kind of inherently inclusive is because it allowed folks from radically different experiences and demographics like a way into feminism and a way into Marxist thought. So like a white middle-class housewife a la the feminine mystique could read a Wages for Housework pamphlet and relate to the like banal, ever-present demands of homemaking. And a sex worker may be drawn to the aspects of the movement that recognize that sex and intimacy is work. Mm-hmm. And a woman of color might kind of draw attention to the racialized aspects of care work and how the positions of maids and nannies were predominantly held by women of color, and see the Wages for Housework movement as potentially leading to better working conditions and pay. Basically, it's like, come for housework as a bitch, stay for worker uprising.
Nice.
And at the International Tribunal on Crimes Against Women, which was held in Brussels in 1976, so around 4 years after the IFC was founded, some like 2,000 women from 40 countries gathered to discuss how to eradicate violence against women globally. And different Wages for Housework groups were in attendance, and they presented a resolution in favor of wages for housework at the end of the tribunal, and it passed almost unanimously by all participants. Like, how fucking rare is that, to get a room full of feminists to agree on anything?
Yeah.
But <That's fantastic. laughs> by 1978, the momentum behind the IFC and the Wages for Housework movement kind of began to lose steam, and different chapters began not to show up to conferences, and the movement started splintering. And I'll get later to what the movement did and didn't accomplish, but first, I thought we'd have Silvia Federici introduce us to Wages for Housework.
Mm-hmm.
In 1975, she wrote a pamphlet called Wages Against Housework. And it's confusing that the Wages for Housework movement also said Wages Against Housework. And it's just, we're going to move past that. And for myself, like Silvia Federici's essay, which is like a little pamphlet, it was how I was introduced to the movement. And I thought it'd be a good starting point for you and our listeners. And for those who don't know, Silvia Federici is an Italian and American Marxist feminist scholar and activist. She also perhaps has the most name recognition when it comes to Wages for Housework. So this is the opening of the pamphlet, and I thought you could read it for us.
Sure. Okay. Many times the difficulties and ambiguities which women express in discussing wages for housework stem from the reduction of wages for housework to a thing, a lump of money, instead of viewing it as a political perspective. The difference between these two standpoints is enormous. To view wages for housework as a thing rather than a perspective is to detach the end result of our struggle from the struggle itself and to miss its significance in demystifying and subverting the role to which women have been confined in a capitalist society.
Mm-hmm. So Federici starts the essay by drawing attention to the myth that housework is a labor of love. And we talked a bit about this in the Of Woman Born episode, where kind of feminists were recognizing that calling something natural for women to do, like raising children or caring for the house, was a really easy way to not pay women for their work. Mm-hmm. And to break the cycle of the labor of love myth, women have to realize that their exploitation of the home is part of the project of capitalism, and that capitalism rests in part on unwaged work of women. Mm-hmm. And while housework is work, it's also different compared to waged labor. And Federici explains this distinction. And she writes, "True, under capitalism, every worker is manipulated and exploited, and his her relation to capital is totally mystified. The wage gives the impression of a fair deal. You work and you get paid. Hence, you and your boss are equal. While in reality, the wage, rather than paying for the work you do, hides all the unpaid work that goes into profit. But the wages at least recognize that you are a worker, and you can bargain and struggle around and against the terms and the quantity of that wage, the terms and quantity of that work. To have a wage means to be part of a social contract, and there is no doubt concerning its meaning. You work not because you like it or because it comes naturally to you, but because it's the only condition under which you're allowed to live in. But exploited as you might be, you are not that work. Today you are a postman, tomorrow a cab driver. All that matters is about how much of that work you have to do and how much money you can get." And she goes on and says, "But in the case of housework, the situation is qualitatively different than waged work. The difference lies in the fact that not only has housework been imposed on women, but it has been transformed into a natural attribute of our female physique and personality, an internal need and aspiration supposedly coming from the depths of our female character. Housework has to be transformed into a natural attribute rather than to be recognized as a social contract, because from the beginning of capital scheme for women, this work was designed to be unwaged. Capital has convinced us that it is natural, unavoidable, and even fulfilling activity to make us accept our unwaged work." Mm-hmm. So, yeah, long paragraphs. I'm basically reading like a fourth of the pamphlet because it's very short. And in the second part of the essay, she shifts to discussion of like the revolutionary possibilities that Wages for Housework invites. Because at its root, Wages for Housework is a movement born from Marxism and community action and grassroots organizing. And it's a political perspective, like I said, and like a starting point for further action. Now here's another quote from Federici. "Wages for Housework is a revolutionary demand, not because by itself it destroys capital, but because it attacks capital and forces it to restructure social relations in terms more favorable to us and consequently more favorable to the unity of the class. In fact, demand wages for housework does not mean to say that if we are paid, we will continue to do it. It means precisely the opposite. To say that we want money for housework is the first step towards refusing to do it, because the demand for a wage makes our work visible, which is the most indispensable condition to begin our struggle against it, both in its immediate aspect as housework and its more insidious character as femininity." And critics say that Wages for Housework kind of in the movement entrenches housework as women's work and would really legitimize the gender division of labor. And that Wages for Housework, if successful, you'd have male partners would be even less likely to contribute to house and care work if women were receiving a wage. Critics also said that Wages for Housework was commodifying love and care.
If you could see my face right now, listeners, I'm very concerned by that. I got a furrowed brow.
And like, that's a really literal interpretation. It's like seeing one that sees the movement as a proposed solution to women's work instead of like a political perspective towards liberation. Essentially, like, many critics were caught in like the liberal, neoliberal feminist mode of thought, where like true emancipation and empowerment for women could only come from joining the waged workforce.
Yeah.
In researching this episode, I read a book, a whole book.
Nice.
I was dedicated. I bought it and everything. That's called Wages for Housework, A History of an International Feminist Movement, 1972 to 1977, by Louise Toupin. How would you say?
Sounds French. Toupin.
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 Toupin. I don't know. She's French. She was a member of the Quebec Women's Liberation Front and was a professor at UQAM, University of Quebec in Montreal, in the political science department. And it was cool to have a book that was centered in Canada. And because, you know, we're a Canadian podcast, even though
we're kind of a transnational podcast.
We are kind of a transnational podcast. Hopefully Harbinger keeps us, because
I don't know if you can even, can you say transnational when you're just talking about Canada and the US?
I don't know.
We're almost the
Yeah, we're like those border towns in between Vermont and Canada, where like if you're in someone's living room, you're in Canada. And then if you're in some, you know, that kind of vibe.
We're that.
So yeah, book written by a Canadian author from a really Canadian and Quebecois perspective. And it charts the heyday of the Wages for Housework movement. And the author knows a lot of the key players personally, just kind of through the feminist scene of the time. But interestingly, the Wages for Housework movement as a kind of international force was not really big in Francophone feminism and in Quebec feminism. Mm-hmm. And there's reasons around language and, you know, Quebec relating more to French feminism versus kind of English language feminism. So Louise is writing this kind of at a little bit of a distance because she is very Francophone, which also kind of adds a layer of not objectivity, because obviously you can't be objective, that's a myth, but kind of looking out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what she talks about in the beginning of the book is kind of why Wages for Housework was not fully embraced by the feminist movement. And it's, you know, similar to what I was saying before, that feminists thought that the best way to kind of have gender parity in all aspects of life was just to have more women in the workforce. And that kind of who ends up doing housework was just something between partners. Mm-hmm. A big element of this book is her teasing out the different threads of Marxism and feminism and Marxist feminism that made up the global Wages for Housework movement. Mm-hmm. And a lot of feminists in the 70s turned to Marxism to kind of help theorize their experience of oppression and exploitation, both in the labor market and at home. Louise Toupin includes in her book part of this quote from Engels' book, The Origin of Family, Private Property, and the State, where he says, "To emancipate women and to make her the equal of man is and remains impossible so long as a woman is shut out from social productive labor and restricted to private domestic labor." And he goes on to say kind of that the emancipation of women will be possible only when women take part in productions on large social scale, and domestic work is not that much, doesn't take that much time anymore. Essentially, through industrialization, domestic work, the demand for it will be less and less. And so women can focus more on, you know, regular workforce labor. And I don't really agree with that. A great example is this book called More Work for Mother, The Ironies of Household Technologies from the Open Hearth to the Microwave, which kind of looks at the ways that the goalpost of what is considered adequate homemaking has changed with industrialization. Mm-hmm. So people would think now that you have a dishwasher, and now that you have, an electric sewing machine, now that you have a microwave, this makes it easier for women to do domestic work. And that's true. They don't need to, necessarily wash the clothes by hand, but the expectations of what's considered a clean outfit or, a put together outfit has changed. What's considered a presentable meal has changed. Mm-hmm. So no matter what the technology does, women still end up doing housework. You can have a whole Google Home set up and everything be automated, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you then don't do any housework.
Yeah. When I feel like you said in the beginning of the episode, like we're talking about housework, but we're also talking about like all the, I hate to say emotional labor, because I feel like that's like a very overused term and it's used completely wrong. So if I'm using it wrong, like let me know. But like there are like aspects to this that are really emotional. Like I remember reading about the fact that like women in, this was very much talking about heterosexual cis couples, will do like the work of like keeping the family together. So like, oh, have you called your mom this week? Oh, your sister's in town next week. We should make sure we get together with her. And like, you know, like not only keeping your own like blood relatives connected, but also your partner's blood relatives connected, and like organizing the parties and the dinners and stuff. And I feel like no amount of like industrialization can really change that. Unless we get robots. That just sounds horrible.
Yeah, that sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just like different, there are emotional aspects to it that just like can't be sort of replaced by any technology.
So Marxism kind of set the groundwork for the wages for housework movement, but there were kind of different perspectives that feminists had in this movement of like why wages for housework was so important and what were the origins of women's oppression in the home. So you had someone like Margaret Benson who is saying like women are like a specific group of workers. So she says like the fact that women, despite all the differences among them, are assigned this work en masse constitutes them as a group with a specific relationship with production. In arguing that the roots of secondary status of women are in fact economic, it can be shown that women as a group do indeed have a definite relation to the means of production, and this is different from men. Mm-hmm. And then you have someone like the French feminist Christine Delphi, where she's saying like the existence of two modes of production in our society is established by one, most goods are produced in the industrial mode, and two, domestic services, child rearing, and a certain number of goods are produced in the family mode. The first mode of production gives rise to capitalist exploitation. The second gives rise to familiar, or more precisely, patriarchal exploitation. And then you have one of the mothers of the movement, Maria Rosa de la Costa, who says, if the family is the center of production, essential to capitalism to life, it will also be the center of subversion, especially if women refuse to work there.
Mm. I feel like this, like, we really kind of, like, saw this, like, it's sort of like a chain reaction, I guess. Like, this labor has to be done in the home, or you have to find someone else to do it so that labor outside of the home can be done. And if you don't have one, then you don't have the other, I guess. Yeah. And, like, I feel like it got, like, really, you really saw examples of that during the pandemic where like people weren't like comfortable with having people in their home, or you know, daycares and schools were closed, so there was suddenly this like urgent need for mothers who have, you know, other jobs outside of the home, or you know, parents outside that have jobs outside of the home, to come home and like deal with the imminent labor that needs to be done, which is child rearing and housework. But then like their, you know, capitalist production jobs can't get done. And so it you know, screws up the whole like chain.
Oh, completely. There's, for researching this episode, I found a lot of kind of old feminist posters. One of which I'm sure will be like the cover image for this episode. And there's one that's like a red and white print of kind of an assembly line with a factory in the background. And it says like capitalism also depends on domestic labor. And in the front, you have an assembly line of like men coming out of the factory and getting on a conveyor belt, where then like the woman will like comfort them and feed them and iron their clothes and like give them food. And then the man gets off the assembly line and like goes back to work at the factory, presumably to work on an assembly line. Yeah, it is very much like a chain reaction. And it makes a lot of sense that, you know, looking at Marxism as a way to find an exit through the kind of the monotony of worker exploitation. Like, yeah, I get that. There's also all of these three women had a lot to say about like use value versus exchange value, which again, we have established, I'm not great with a lot of the Marxist terminology. So, like, some feminists, like Margaret Bestin, say that, like, housework produces no exchange value. Like, you can't, it's not like you're going to a store with, like, a pair of shoes that you made, you know. You can't really exchange in the market square housework.
Right.
But okay. It's still crucial to capitalism. Mm-hmm. And then, like, others, like De La Costa, say that, like, housework is productive because it produces and reproduces labor power.
Right.
And then you have someone like Delphi, who's an example of, like, a materialist feminist, where she sees, like, free domestic labor as conceived as a mode of production within, like, the patriarchy. Mm. And De La Costa, who's a Marxist feminist, sees free domestic labor as conceived as a mode of production within capitalism.
Right.
So kind of in a move surprising nobody, there was a bunch of debate over kind of wages for housework and what's called, like, the domestic labor debate. And, like, also, like, if you don't see housework as work, like, the whole wages for housework movement, like, isn't going to seem like a plausible option. Like, regardless of whether or not you or I have read all of the theory, the wages for housework movement, like I said before, like, gave you a really easy in because it was so accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if you're doing housework and care work all day, you may not have time to keep up with, like, the latest feminist debates over housework and care work. Mm-hmm. That's why pamphlets were great. That's why there was so much kind of direct action.
Yeah.
You might be, you know, Marxist feminist and see the issue as capitalism, or a materialist feminist and see the issue as patriarchy, or neither, and you still see there's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, regardless of what kind of camp of feminism you fall into, like, all roads lead to wages for housework.
Yeah.
Wages for housework, kind of as a concept, like, receiving money from the government for, you know, doing especially care work, like, isn't new. And the wages for housework movement in the 70s was built upon, like, crucial work from the welfare rights movement, which was led by Black women in the U.S., and the unsupported mothers' unions in the U.K. that was happening a decade before. And before that, like, since the early 1800s, there were various movements, typically led by women, for government wages for homemakers and families. And it was often called public family allowances. And they were implemented within various successes throughout the 1900s. Typically, a family allowance from the government was, like, a tiny sum of money that was distributed through the mail weekly. I think in Ireland for a while it was weekly. In Canada, it was monthly. And for stay-at-home mothers, like, this was the only cash that was, like, theirs. It wasn't belonging to their husband. It wasn't a lot. And you typically had to use it to buy things for your children and your family, but, you know, it was the only kind of money you had if you weren't working.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about family allowances is that they were only distributed to women who had children.
Right.
The Wages for Housework movement campaigned for family allowances, like, when governments wanted to cut the allowance or change it. There was a while where they wanted to just add allowance to husbands' paychecks at work, mm-hmm. which then takes away, you know, women having any money of their own if they're not working.
Yeah.
But kind of the victories in these fights to keep family allowances were, you know, kind of partial victories because only mothers received this, again, very small sum of money.
Yeah, right.
So the general line from the Wages for Housework movement about family allowances was, like, don't cut the program unless you're going to replace it with universal wages for housework. In fact, why don't you just do the universal wages for housework movement? Like,
right. Yeah. And I feel like, yeah, in, like, a today's context, we could see this as, like, a, like, universal basic income, mm-hmm. just, like, making sure that, like, everyone can, I don't know, afford their basic needs, and then, you know, not have to work, like, 50 hours a week, and then maybe they'll have time to do their housework.
Exactly.
And just, like, the things that make them feel good in their space at home, and, like, yeah, like, engage in that, like, sort of, like, kinship labor. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know.
No, it's really true. And the pandemic, again, like, definitely people were receiving, you know, stimulus checks or unemployment more. People were, at least some people were getting, you know, more consistent support from the government.
Serb was the wealthiest I've been.
I did in, like, so many friends who said years. The same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, you're giving me how much money a month?
And, this is great.
Okay. More of this, please.
So I definitely think, like, the ideas around universal basic income or more, you know, kind of consistent and involved government support for everyone has kind of gained some more kind of popular cultural support. And it's also good because, you know, having a kind of more universal income, like wages for housework would do for women, it's not dependent on whether or not a woman is a mother, or if the woman's married. And that kind of makes me, I want to talk a little bit about, like, the wages due lesbian chapters, which were wages due lesbians, which I think now is called Queer Strike, was kind of a sub branch of the Wages for Housework movement. And they had pretty prominent chapters in Toronto, London, Brooklyn, and San Francisco. And they were arguing that all women should receive wages for housework because all women do house and care work, even if they're not heterosexual, even if they're, you know, single. So here's a quote from the Wages Due Collective Toronto chapter in the late 1970s, where it says, like, people sometimes say that single women don't do housework, especially lesbians. All women do housework. This is our role. This is what we are all expected to do. When we work outside the home, much of the work we do is unpaid housework. We have all been taught the skills of licking ass, making coffee, being feminine, keeping quiet, etc. But this work is not included in our job description. This training is not included in our pay packet. And when we've finished our job, we don't go home to a wife. We have to cook our own supper, do our own laundry, clean up, pay the bills, etc. Another kind of branch of the movement was Black women for wages for housework. And that kind of, as a concrete coalition, started after Wilmette Brown gave a lecture called Autonomy of Black Lesbian Women at the Wages Due Lesbian Conference in Toronto. And she drew attention to Black women's unique relationship to housework. Just as labor is gendered, it's also racialized. And enslaved women's work was contrasted against, like, the work of the white female mistress. And then these kind of dynamics of white work versus non-white work existed, you know, in Jim Crow era and continue today. And
yeah, the amount of, like, women, at least in Canada, that, like, work in like domestic roles, like as nannies or as home care workers or as cleaners, that have, like, precarious status, especially is like, it's an industry that is dominated by women that have precarious status and make pennies.
And who deserve not only, you know, the full force behind Wages for Housework movement, but also a more kind of specialized branch of the movement focusing directly on Black women and women of color, immigrant women struggles.
Yeah, because, like, what happens when you have precarious status is that you can be like extremely exploited in your workplace, and, like, you're not gonna, like, say anything to your boss because often your residence relies on you being employed, and, you know, if it means, like, exploitation versus deportation, you know, you're gonna stay in your shitty job
completely. And also, who hires a lot of, you know, domestic workers who are women of color or have, you know, precarious citizenship is the so-called liberated white women of joining the workforce, or rich women who joined the workforce. So again, just the liberal feminist solution to dealing with issues of inequality in home gendered homemaking is doesn't work because someone ends up having to do the work. Like, at the end of the day, no matter how much automation you do, no matter, you know, if you're doing it yourself or you're employing someone else to do it, like, someone does the housework. And no amount of kind of girl bossing your way will prevent that from just happening. The New York chapter of the Wages for Housework Committee held, like, a specific welfare conference in Brooklyn, And during this conference, like, Black women pointed out, like, the power relations between Black and white women when it came to employment. And they also emphasized how women of color received, like, the lowest wages compared to their white and male peers. Mm-hmm. And during this conference, it was announced officially that, like, the Black female participants of the movement would be forming their own autonomous coalition within the broader international Wages for Housework movement called Black Women for Wages for Housework.
Right.
And other branches of the Wages for Housework movement that we got, branches around the rights of lesbian women to maintain custody of their children, rights around reproductive justice and workplace discrimination and gendered and racial pay disparities, branches around support specifically for sex workers and support kind of for women's shelters and social services and support for migrants' rights and the rights of overseas workers. So all of these different beautiful little tree branches were shooting out, but all kind of tied to this, you know, one concrete demand of, like, we deserve mm-hmm. our wages, our work to be recognized. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it kind of fizzled. The movement mm-hmm. fizzled. And, like, you can't really blame it on one thing. Like, I've, you know, tried to figure it out what happened. And like anything, there's a bunch of different kind of things at play. Like, one reason that, you know, we don't have wages for housework, or that it's not more popular or well known, like, by feminists, is that it was always, like, a more radical perspective, especially in academic and more, like, conservative feminist spaces. And a lot of, you know, the support behind wages for housework was coming, like, on the ground. Other reasons, like, Americans are scared of communism.
What?
So the idea that you're bringing in, like, this Marxist feminist solution and giving away free money, as you'd say, mm-hmm. also was not helping. And a lot of disagreements between, like, members and factions of the movement, yeah. which you see a lot. But
the left will always eat itself.
The left will always eat itself. Like we were saying earlier, like, it is, you know, not necessarily the capital W wages for housework movement, but ideas around being compensated for the labor you do both in and out mm-hmm. of the home. Like, that has been gaining steam again. The pandemic, you know, really highlighted, like, what kind of work was essential. And yeah. people receiving more consistent government assistance was helpful. And Silvia Federici has been in the news a lot, talking, writing books, doing things, going for walks. I don't know. I kind of want to leave it on this really great thing existed that included so many different feminists, which is mm-hmm. so rare for the time. And then it wasn't really successful. At the end of the day, like, it is both a concrete set of demands and a political perspective. And so
right.
if we're looking at kind of the second dimension of the movement, like, that was successful. Mm-hmm. We have a whole region of little, you know, army of young leftist thinkers who are really, can all just agree, like, this is work. And mm-hmm. sex work is work. And, like, all of these different types of work are work and deserve to be compensated. Yeah.
And are essential, and you can really easily see how our social fabric kind of crumbles without them.
Yeah.
Did you know in Quebec, the first year of the pandemic, 2020 to 2021, there were more drowning pool deaths of children than, like, any other year? And what they – yeah, like, kids drowning in backyard pools.
Okay.
And what they've, like, attributed it to, I can find this, it is substantiated, but and yeah, they, like, attributed it to the fact that, like, parents were home from work, they didn't have proper childcare, their kids were just, like, running around, you know, and not properly supervised, and not, like, you know, they weren't maybe going to the babysitter's house because they're, you know, of the pandemic and whatever, and yeah, so a bunch of kids drowned.
Wow.
And it's like, yeah, like, I feel like that really illustrates, like, how essential, like, things like nannies are and childcare and, like, or having the capacity to care for your children and not lose your job.
Or having, you know, a real community and support system and family yeah. and, you know, like, to be able to Yeah, because not to be like, it takes a village to raise a child. We say to people who do not have children. But no, I think that's definitely true. Like, kids were really, really running wild, especially like first couple months of the pandemic. One of the 8-year-olds I nanny for, she told me about a friend of hers, a classmate of hers, who during the first few months of the pandemic trained a wild squirrel to eat out of her hand. Like, every day she'd sit on the porch and, like, just over days after days, like, get this squirrel to eventually, like, come up and eat out of her hand.
Honestly, this sounds like a very Vermont thing, but this sounds like something that you all do.
I mean, I guess what would the Montreal get? You sit and eventually the traffic cones learn to trust you and come up and snuggle you.
That's right.
And, yeah, so that's kind of the end of the era of second wave feminism from a historical timeline and from a us not talking about it for a little bit, maybe, timeline.
Yeah. Well, it's good though, because like I feel like I know a lot of my episodes have been like, here's the second wave feminist thing or first wave feminist thing, and here's why it's shit.
So yeah, that's all I have for you today.
Cool.
So next week we will talk about nannies and wages and unions, and how would you best describe it?
Yeah, I'm writing an article about my history as working as a nanny, and sort of the language of like your family and how that's like weaponized to like make people work in like really shit conditions. And I'm going to talk about labor unions for nannies and houseworkers and domestic workers and why it's never happened and why it's really hard, but why we should do it.
Fuck yeah. All right. Yeah. We'll see you next time then.
See you next week.